Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. You like adventure? Well, how about this? What's it like to spend the last three decades traveling around more than 70 countries, bouncing between minus 26 degrees Fahrenheit and 129 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on the shoot, being clawed, chased, shot at, diseased, lost, injured, incarcerated, and most importantly, getting your finger stitched back on twice? Well, my guest knows. He's award-winning photographer, TV host, and conservationist Jason Edwards, and he knows what it takes to get the perfect shot. National Geographic photographer Jason Edwards is author of Icebergs to Iguanas, Photographic Journeys Around the World. It's a large format series of books illustrating his National Geographic imagery, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And you can follow Jason, that's with an O, on Instagram and Facebook. And Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you. I almost live vicariously through you since I don't do much. So I'm going to take your adventures as my own, and therefore I've had an exciting life.
No, that's all right. You probably have less medical bills than I do.
I think so. So how did you do all this with an Instamatic camera?
Well, I used to be 6'4". Now I think I'm 4'6" and rapidly shrinking with the weight of the gear that I have to carry around.
Yeah, well, when you first started so many decades ago, it was obviously in a non-digital world, and then it became digital. So was there technically, because you didn't have to carry rolls of film, less weight, or because you had extra external drives, it was more weight, or was it a balance between it?
No, it's interesting because the gear allegedly has become lighter as technology's improved. But you actually take more in the digital space because you have power converters and chargers and laptops and hard drives and all of those things. And so I don't think the weight has really changed that much for me, to be honest, Ira. The thing I loved about film, and I was a late converter to digital by some standards, I loved going around with 100 rolls of Kodachrome 64 and couple of hundred AA batteries, and then I didn't have to do anything in the evenings. If I was shooting in the evenings, it was just shooting. You know, there was none of this downloading and backing up, and then you sit there going, did I get it? Didn't I get it? It was just the film was carried in an old lead bag wrapped in some torn old plastic duty-free bags tied with string. I looked like a hobo. And no one ever realized that that was basically 100 rolls of very expensive film.
Right.
And I really had that set up for probably a good 15 years, those same torn plastic bags. And to be honest with you, I do miss that time in more often than not. Yeah,
I mentioned the temperature range in the opening, and I'm just thinking, never mind you as a human, what about that film? How do you keep the film secure when you've got these temperatures ranging from freezing to overheating?
And that was the wonderful thing with Kodachrome, because it was such a low ISO, it really handled the temperature shifts well without having color shifts. And I actually still shoot film now on every assignment. So I'll take the digital gear, and I've got a very old beaten Hasselblad panoramic that's been around the planet about 57,000 times. And so I'll still shoot film every assignment, but just in panoramic. And I love it, because when I'm shooting, I'm relying on all of that knowledge that I should have acquired over decades in the field.
Absolutely. I'm going to talk about the first volume of the series of books in a few minutes, but I wanted to get a flavor of your background and a flavor of your technique. And something that's always interested me as a professional photographer, how do you see something differently in the lens than those of us who don't shoot on a regular basis do, amateur photographers or people that will shoot a decent shot, but there's something that you, with a trained eye and experience, can see, including light, shadow, composition, whatever else goes into that. How do you do that?
That's a fantastic question. I don't think I've ever been asked before, to be honest.
Well, that's why I'm here, Jason.
That's right. You're there to break new ground. Just break that ground, buddy.
Exactly.
And well, I mean, it's interesting because when I was growing up, I painted and drew, especially with pencil early, and then I went to oils, and a lot of it was surrealism and other unusual forms of the arts, and you know, a lot of my teachers and parents and everything thought that's the path I would take, but I was very heavily focused on what shouldn't belong in my compositions, even as a child and as a teenager, than what should belong. And so when I started taking photos, which was during high school, I suddenly realized that back then there was no internet. You remember the days you bought magazines and books and things.
Right.
So as I started photographing, it wasn't long before I realized I was getting quite distressed about seeing what other people were creating, because that was governing my vision. Now, these days, everyone's used to looking at social media and saying, I want to replicate that or I want to do this. But back in the day, to coin the phrase, there wasn't that opportunity. So I think probably when I was about 24, I just stopped buying books and magazines and looking at what other photographers did who had bigger budgets, better gear, all of those things, more interesting locations than I had access to, because I wanted to form my own style. So because I'd come from that drawing and painting background in my own existence, I think when I started photographing seriously, I was trying to replicate that in my compositions. And, you know, we might touch on it, but I was a zookeeper at Melbourne Zoo, and one of the curators was a photographer from Germany, and he'd moved to curate Melbourne Zoo. And I was a young buck. I was always in trouble, you know, going out every night with money in my pocket and turning up late to work. And being German, you know, they're pretty efficient, these curators. I had two German curators. And he called me into the office one day, and I thought he was definitely going to nail me for something.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I want to talk about your photography. And I thought, oh, here we go. And he literally sat me down, and I was maybe 18 or 19, and he said, you do things with a camera that I can't do. And, you know, when you're young, you think you know it all and all of those things. And I respected him immensely. He was immensely important in my early career. But the conversation progressed, and he said, what I want you to do is start seeing the world in 2x3 consciously, which is 35mm format. Mm-hmm. So vertical in portrait orientation, landscape orientation. He said, you're doing it unconsciously, but I want you to spend 6 or 9 months just seeing the rectangle, you know, in everything you do. If you're at home with your partner, if you're shopping for food, if you're out on a trip that you're funding yourself, everything. And he said, it'll take you that long, but I think it will change your photography. And he was 100% correct. And so for the next 6 or 9 months, I physically imagined, you know, the golden rectangle in these days, you know, the dot, dot, dot of 2x3. And I've got to be honest with you, when partners found out that that's what I was doing 24 hours a day, it led to some pretty serious arguments.
Yeah, I would think so.
They realized I was looking at our whole relationship as a photo. once that became a permanent part of my psyche in a conscious way, when I'm in the field, to the heart of your question, I guess, is mm-hmm. that I'm always on the clock. I can't turn it off. I mean, you know, that I see the world as a photo 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And even now I could recompose your bagel background in about 100 frames.
You know? I'm sure you could, yes. Now, I guess the larger question of Jason is, there's another one that you haven't been asked before, is that healthy?
No, it is not healthy. It is far from healthy. And look, that is the juxtaposition of my life. I live quite a duality. I travel so much. Sometimes I'm in 10, 20, 30 countries a year, depending on the shoots that I'm doing. With modern travel now, I can get back home, well, depending on where I am, in 24, 38, 48, you know, sometimes 75 hours it takes me to get home. But when I come home, I can't turn that off. And of course, in the middle of the night, my body's always in some time zone creatively. Even if I'm at home with my family, my brain is at a subconscious level thinking about what I've just captured or where I'm going next. So I often wake, I'm not an insomniac, but I often wake in the middle of the night thinking about imagery. And that can be, as anyone who, and I'm sure you've interviewed many creatives in your career, that mm-hmm. that dichotomy, that roller coaster ride of being a creative can be quite destructive depending on where you are in the ride. You know, if you're on the way down, it can be terrible. If you're on the way up, it's potential. If you're at the top, it's like, this is what I live for. And all of those, you know, permutations and combinations therein lie, you know. So it can be quite difficult. And I'm quite hard on myself as well. If I feel like I didn't see a composition, if I didn't work the scene well, then I'm quite hard on myself. But also too, you know, I'm paid to make images, not excuses. So that's the motto by which I live. And the other thing is too, is every frame for me has to be better or different. Now, I can't compare myself to the rest of the world. That's not for me to do. I don't think it's for anyone to do. It's one of the most unhealthy things of social. But for me personally, if I repeat visit a location for a long-term story, and I'm doing lions in the Serengeti, for example, every time I see a lion is a gift. It's a lion in the wild. It's a gift.
Exactly.
Am I going to get something different? Well, hopefully. But if I don't, and I've got better images from 20 years ago, that doesn't mean I've failed, but I also need to make sure I try and do it better or different than I've done it before.
Two more questions, and then we'll get into the book itself, which I find fascinating. It's volume one of the series. But the question still sticks in my mind that once you reach a certain level, as you did at an early age too, which was great, by shooting for National Geographic, did you have to up even your game to get the quality that they require from their photographers?
Very much so. I think it was one of the things that was taught to me when I first went to Washington, when I was first invited to come to National Geographic and submit, and I quote, you know, my 150 frames that told the story of my career. So they'd published a little bit of my work in the magazine and then invited me to Washington. Probably one of the most seminal things that was said to me during the early reviews was from one of the directors of the magazine, and she had the big loop on the imagery on the light box, and she said, how does your mind work this way? That is a line that you could go to your grave with as being one of the most important lines a photographer could ever hear. But also too, when I was contracted, I presented that 150 frames, I think 40 times in 10 days to different department heads. It was quite intense. But when I was finally offered the contract, when a contract of representation slid across the desk, I went to take it. And then the vice president at the time said, before you take this, we are going to dot, dot, dot. And it was a litany of disasters. It was like, we are going to make you more ill, more, you know, fold more marriages, you know, get you more injured. You know, you will work on stories for years and we will say no, and then we will yell at you and you will cry and all of these sorts of things. And I sort of went, wow. And of course I heard it all. I was still going to sign the contract, but everything that she said, and I love and respect her to this day, but everything she said has happened. You know, it was, there's not room for excuses, and they're not interested in how good you are at post-production. They want the raw, whether it's a negative, because a lot of people are shooting film again, or the digital raw. I mean, you can be the best person and do 5 hours on an image, but that doesn't really mean anything if you haven't got the story in the raw file to them. That's been my experience, at least.
So instead of folding your tent after getting that advice and that warning, you didn't fold your tent, you pitched it all away around the world.
Correct, yeah. So that was the moment I left that meeting, and so Australian here. I every day I'd go to the same bar. It was a bit like Cheers, you know. I'd have my meeting, I'd go and have a few drinks, and so I knew the barman and I knew the waitress that was on every afternoon. I'd walk in and you know, in typical American fashion, so generous and so welcoming. But that day when I said, "Oh my God, look what I've just been given," there was shouts and they brought oysters out and everything. It was amazing. they went sideways from there, obviously. But I remember sitting there by myself trying to absorb what had happened, you know, going, okay, where is this going to go? What impact is this going to have on my life? But I'm a glasses three quarters kind of full guy. You know, I looked at it all as an opportunity, and then, you know, the path ahead for me has always been a mystery. So it was like, okay, I'm taking this turn now, and let's just see where it goes without any expectation of fame or fortune or anything like that. It was just like, wow, you know, wow. And then one step at a time, I think I tried to manifest my time and to do what they needed done, depending on which department of National Geographic I was working for.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story that of your career. And as I mentioned in the opening, where you've been all over the world, and they could sort of follow your adventures as well on social media, on Instagram, and also on Facebook. And again, the book, and I'm going to get to it right now, it's called Icebergs to Iguanas, Photographic Journeys Around the World. It's a large format book, volume one. And this is the last question that still sticks in my mind. Because we discussed it earlier about the equipment and the weight and how you still shoot film, even though you have the digital and you've got the cords and you've got to have some food with you and all of that. Do you find that year after year, is it harder to lug that stuff around?
Oh, mate, I tell you, God almighty, that is the understatement. I mean, look, it's the answer is yes, it does get harder. There's no two ways about it. One of the things that people, I think, don't realize about photography, especially for someone like me who gets the opportunities, and it's a privilege to go to the places I work in. It's a privilege.
Absolutely.
And I'm not immune to that. I'm not ignorant of that at all. But what they don't realize is that I'm not on holiday. I mean, I'm there to work. I rise every morning probably at about 4:30 some, and then I'll finish depending, maybe I have to have dinner with some people, or because I'm representing National Geographic, or maybe I'm just in the field in a tent. And then you do your downloads, you do all of that sort of thing. I don't think I get more than probably 4 hours of sleep a night a day, if I'm lucky. And I can do 2 days, 3 days straight without going to bed if I'm working the Amazon and there's insects at night and other animals during the day or whatever. But when I get home, and this is, as I said, that duality of existence, you can't do that unless you put in the time at home. So I'm not a gym junkie per se. I'm a swimmer by trade. I swam competitively for many years. So I swim multiple times a week. I ride my bike every day. I'm on the treadmill. I'm reasonably solid, I guess, but I do a little bit of weights, but they're not bulking weights. They're tendon weights. It's all of these sorts of shoulders and arms and neck and back and chest.
Because it's toning. It's like toning more than...
100%, yeah. Right. Because if I put heavy weights on, I've got to be honest with you, I get really big quickly. And then that makes it harder to do what I do. So I will be training on average probably at least six times a week, more maybe, when I'm at home, purely because if I don't, when I go back into the field and I put that, you know, that 35, 40 kilogram backpack, which is, you know, 70 to 100 pounds, you know, on my back, and I've got to walk with it every day. But I've also got to create as I'm going. I'm changing lenses. I'm picking up cameras, all of that kind of thing. I'm squatting. I'm up. I'm down. If I don't do that, I would be broken. So training for me, I love it. I love doing some exercise. And it also, you know, it helps with the gin and the wine. Let's be realistic. Yes. If you don't train, you put on the pounds. If I could stop eating chips and Tim Tams, our famous chocolate biscuit, you know, I'd be cut like a snake, you know. But, you know, the physicality of it, I have noticed, you know, changes as time's gone by, but I put in the hard yards when I'm at home. Right. And a story that surprised me, we had a very well-known National Geographic photographer. He's been there 50 years. He was in Australia doing some project. We had dinner. There was a group of people around, and he sort of looked at me. He was tired. I was tired. I'd come back into the field. He was doing his work. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you are the last of the Mohicans. And I burst out laughing. The whole table was watching. And I sort of laughed. I said, what do you mean? And he said, at Geographic, no one's doing the miles you're doing. No one's out there, you know. He said, someone stubs their toenail, they make a documentary out of it. We laugh. We're having some wine. He said, I just can't understand how you can physically, because his projects now are studio-based rather than field of what he used to do. But, you know, it was fascinating for me to have that insight from someone I respect and who knows how hard field work is, because I don't have a choice. That's the other thing, you know, it's I either stay at home and do other things, which I love my family, I'm happy to do. But if I want to go in the field, I'm pretty merciless on myself, ergo the injuries and the diseases and everything that I experience, because there's no real, there's no door number three. It's I go or I don't go.
Right.
You know, there's no door number three. And I'm fortunate in one element of my life that some people never find that is that as a young person, I knew what I loved and my passion, and I was fortunate enough to make a career out of it. So there's other things I love, and you get older, you see the world differently, but I'm also very aware that that if it gets harder, I either have to push through because I can't really
stop. Right. And the world you see differently as you get older is still in that format we talked about earlier. So
100%, yeah, 100%.
And let's talk a little bit
differently, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the book itself. And how did that come about? Did you, were you involved in it from the very beginning?
I was, yes. So my collection of imagery at National Geographic, they take, when we do shoots, they take some images and they archive them and we use them in the society and so on and so forth. So my collection is one of the largest, I think, equal largest of any field photographer there. Not because I just shoot a lot of places and I shoot differently. So every year when I would go across for meetings, the team would go, where's the monograph? Where's this? Where's the book? And I'd say boldly, you know, as this little convict Aussie, you know, where's the money? You know,
exactly.
And you know, they had a lot of photographers, and so they said, well, there's not the budget. So that conversation happened for many years. And then just before COVID, not knowing COVID, of course, was going to happen, I sat down and I was working with the book division at National Geographic. And I said, look, I know you want to do this. I know you want to create something of my portfolio, but I don't think it's going to happen. You know, with changes in the business and we were acquired by Disney and all of those sorts of things, I'm going to build a team. I'm going to take this journey forward and it'll be our stories and all of those sorts of things. And they said, well, you know, we'd love you to wait. And I said, well, you know, I've been around a long time. I know the process. So I built a team. And so we started that process. And I sat down one day, literally, there's a lot of references to alcohol in this, isn't there? But I sat at my dining table one day. I'm Australian. It's always going to end up that way. I sat at my dining table with a glass of red or a bottle of red, and all I did is I without thinking, without looking at any images, I wrote down stories that had meant something to me personally. Literally just wrote down stories from my career. There was others, but I think there was 40 on the list. Some of them, like the Serengeti, are enormously long-term projects, as is the Antarctic Peninsula and things like that. And so I went, okay, well, here we are. And I said to my stage one editor, what do you think? She said, what would be your favorites? And I said, well, this, this, and this. And then we added some more in, and then we added some more stories in. And they had me write the draft for, I went back to my field journals, I keep field journals, for 16 stories, and then out of the 40. And then we started that process. And the irony is that when we did a dummy layout of those 16 stories with not enough images in it, there wasn't masses of text, as you know. The book was about this thick. And they sort of said,
yes,
you know, we need to split this. We need to do multiple volumes so that we can tour the world and explore the dichotomy of life and culture and wildlife and things. And so we started out with some of the stories in the book are broken into multiple sections, of course, but we started out with these initial selection of stories. And then in the next volume, it's like a rainbow serpent in traditional culture, Indigenous Australian culture. It'll wind its way through the landscape, changing the landscape as it goes. So future volumes will not be chronological because some of those stories have, as in Icebergs to Iguanas, images that I shot in 1992 and images that I shot in 2019 or 2020. So, you know, the story is the story, and that's the gamble that I took. A lot of photographers, and I'll do this one day, just normally say, here's my favorite 300 pictures, and that's fantastic. It's a great concept.
Right.
But I like to dig holes for myself, and storytelling is more of a challenge. And once I started on this, I realized that the behind-the-scenes perspective and how and why these stories mean so much to me was a passion for me. I love storytelling.
And clearly with your volume of work over the decades, you have enough for, I don't know how many additional volumes. So I'm glad you got the first volume out. Again, it's called Icebergs to Iguanas, Photographic Journeys Around the World. And you mentioned earlier a moment ago that it was a pretty thick book. And so you wanted a coffee table book, but not a book that could break a coffee table.
Yeah, well, that's
some balance in there, right?
that's what I learned from the editorial team. That's not necessarily where I started out. The great thing is if you buy two, you can do bicep curls with them, you know, and it's like, true. We all like biceps, you know, it's like, I have a gorilla build, so biceps are everything to me. So,
right. But you don't want bulk, you want tone. So remember.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And, that's right. It's got some weight to it. But the interesting thing was when we split the book, one of the editors and production directors and I, we sat down and we went, wow, we've now got so many more pages. And then different parts of the team realized that they hadn't had the opportunity to explore to what you were talking about before with the volume, the shoot folders, you know, where I'd created these folders of images, whether shot on transparency, digital, or different types of film in some cases, or different types of digital. And so I remember one day we sat down and one of the team, Todd, he said, what's that on the screen? And I said, oh, that's the shoot folder for whatever story. So I haven't seen this. And I went, no, because originally I was given a cap of like 30 pictures or something per folder. And that changed everything. Suddenly we went back to square one on all the editorial for the images, and the stories changed yet again. And then the book grew in size. So, one thing I did realize driving this, and of course I've been with Geographic for like 24 years now, so you can't have it all. You know, the limitations of publishing mean that there's a gutter in the middle. So some of my favorite images weren't in the book because maybe the giraffe is in the middle of the frame. So I either have to shrink the image to go on one page,
mm-hmm.
or I wait until I do the story on that ecosystem in a book by itself, and then that giraffe image gets this whole spread or something.
Or the double center type of thing where you
exactly,
can...
Exactly, 100%, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
Well, that's quite the challenge. Well, did you have the final say, even though I know how these contracts can be, but did you have the final say about what images would be used and where they would be used in relation to the copy, or is that more a collaborative effort?
It ended up, I mean, technically I could have had the final say, but, and I'm sure that maybe in a couple of cases there were images that went in there because I was so passionate about the story behind them. I'm eidetic about my imagery. If you show me an image, my brain somehow takes me back to that moment in time, almost for all the millions of frames that I've taken. So when we worked as a team, there was obviously times where I had to concede because of the layout limitations or just the page count, really. And I relied on the judgment of multiple editors and people who have decades of skill in the industry to say, Jace, you know, it's not going to fit, you know, or it's not going to work. But right. the other lesson that is, I think, was probably creatively one of the biggest lessons that I learned was that people don't know what they're not getting.
Right.
Which I know, the team knows, but you don't necessarily know that that this very subtle, I'll use the same example, giraffe image underneath a storm cloud and dusty light and everything, that will come into the book on the Serengeti. 100%, it's one of my favourite shots. But when you read the story, you're not sitting there going, well, I actually don't think that, I think there's a giraffe under a storm missing. You know, it's...
Yeah, right.
So that was a fascinating learning curve for me.
We have about a minute left. I just wanted to make sure I got this question in. And it's a trite question, but at the same time, it's profound, which is, in the book, your favorite, absolute favorite, if you had to, again, you never leave yourself an exit. So what's your favorite image in the book?
There's an image, I don't know if favorite's the term I would use, but probably the most impactful image from my memory is there's a single giraffe migrating across in front of the short rains, and there's a wildebeest herd in front of it. And it was the last day of a 3.5 month shoot. It was the first time I'd worked in Africa. I was a teenager or maybe 20. And this herd of wildebeest was crossing the river multiple times. Crocodiles were grabbing them. Lions were grabbing them. And then this single giraffe walked into the scene, and it literally must have gone across an old termite mound because it's a huge male, but it becomes so much taller than the wildebeest surrounding. And I took two frames, one of it here and one of it here, and that single frame that's in the book always reminds me how seminal that assignment was in changing who I was as a person and as a photographer.
That's a great way to leave it. My guest has been National Geographic photographer Jason Edwards. He's author of Icebergs to Iguanas, Photographic Journeys Around the World. It's a large format series of books. This is volume one, illustrating his National Geographic imagery. And it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And you can follow Jason on Instagram and Facebook. And Jason, thanks for being on the show.
Mate, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on IRA's Everything Bagel.